Starting.
Oh, so this is an interview with Doug Hudson by Louise Tumchewix on November 23rd, 2007. So just to begin, where were you born and when?
Winnipeg, Manitoba, mm-hmm. on the 21st of November, 1921.
So, how did you come to join the Royal Canadian Air Force?
Actually, I was on my way to join the Navy, and I got into Winnipeg walking down Main Street. You had to walk down Main Street to get to the... I couldn't afford a bus ticket to get to Ellis Avenue, where the HMCS Chippewa was, the naval unit in Winnipeg. And on my way down Main Street, I looked up and I saw RCAF recruiting. On the spur of the moment, a split second, I went in and said, can I get an air crew? And the sergeant at the desk said, sit down and sign here. So I found myself in the Air Force.
So what year was this?
1942.
42, so you were 21.
Yes.
So right after you joined up, where did you go?
Well, they sent me home for 3 months. When I did get into the Air Force, they took me and swore me in and sent me away for 3 months because all the recruiting areas were plugged up with new recruits mm-hmm. that they'd taken in that we couldn't handle anymore. So they sent me home for 3 months.
And what was the reaction that you got from your family and friends when they found out that you joined the Air Force?
Well, most everybody... There was five of us that in our small district had joined the Air Force. And of that five, I'm the only survivor. The rest, we were all in air crew. Mm-hmm. And my closest friend was a navigator who was on a bombing raid of submarine pens. In France, in occupied France, and he was killed over that raid. That's one. And one was shot down over Norway. He joined the RAF in 1935, and he was shot down over Norway, and he survived and spent the rest four years or more in prisoner of war. And that was one. Another one was teaching flying instructor in Rhodesia, in Africa, and his student froze at the controls, and they were in the circuit on a landing approach, and of course they went in and there was nothing he could do about it because he couldn't move the controls. Students sometimes did that, froze at the controls, and there was nothing that he could do, so he went down.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. So that's three or four of us, can't remember. But there was another fellow that stayed in Europe after the war, and he got a job flying super constellations between Europe and New York from that little prairie town.
Wow.
And he got caught smuggling American dollars into Europe.
Uh-oh.
So that was the end of his European experience. He came back to Manitoba mm-hmm. and got a job with the Manitoba government flying aircraft for them. And he went in at a place called Lac de Bonnet in Manitoba, flying float planes. Mm-hmm. And something happened, I don't know the details, but he went in. So that was another one of the five. And here I am.
The lucky one. So after your 3 month break at home, how were you brought back into the regular process?
When I got back in, they sent me immediately to all math and physics.
Okay.
Checked up at the University of Brandon. Mm-hmm. It was just a college then. Now it's a university. But I got a brush up on math and physics there for 6 weeks. And then they sent me to Lachine, Quebec. And following the math and physics training, I went and took ground crew, training. I was a WAG, so I was math and apparently had to learn Morse code, of course. And that's like, that was a whole, nearly another year, because it's like learning another language, math, Morse code. And then you if you graduated that, then you went on and got gunnery training in Paulson, Manitoba.
What did they do? How were you trained for being a gunner? How did they practice?
Well, they had a Lysander aircraft pulling drogues. Mm-hmm. And the drogue was a big sleeve that they pulled, and we had colored, our bullets were colored. And so you had a certain color, and they counted your color on the bullets that hit the drogue. And I passed that through. From then on, I was home on embarkation leave. I was posted to the West Coast here, to Boundary Bay. And from Boundary Bay, they sent you up the coast. We got these isolated places, and you flew with a bunch of other teenagers. And I was worried about this, because I didn't fancy the fact that I'm flying up the coast of British Columbia in the mountains and the West Coast weather with other teenagers.
It's an understandable fear.
Anyway, I was home on embarkation leave prior to reporting to the West Coast. And my dad was on the phone, and somebody in Ottawa, you know, they were at work already. Of course, we were still in bed in Winnipeg. And I heard my dad stuttering and wondering, questioning who was calling this time of day. Anyway, I went down. And I took the phone from him. Watch that, I'll look, let me have this. So he gave me the phone, and I had inquired, and it was Ottawa phoning us this time of day. It was their working day, they were at work. So I said, well, you're not going to the West Coast, you're going to go overseas. And that's the best words I ever heard, because I didn't want to go to the West Coast in the weather and other kids that I was supposed to be flying with, as I told you.
And the war was going on overseas.
Well, of course the war was, that's where it was at. And so I ended up in Lachine, Quebec. And from there we were held up until we got a trainload of people. And then once we had a troop train formed, then we went to Halifax. And we headed out overseas from Halifax. I barely remember much about Halifax, except that as soon as we got out over, cleared Halifax and were out in the North Atlantic, I was called in and said, you're a gunner. I said, well, I've had gunner training as well as other communication methods. And they said, well, we need gunners up on the bridge. So I got up on the bridge, and I'm on watch for submarines. And here I was. And I might as well be in the Navy.
You ended up in the Navy after all.
So I'm sitting on a bridge strapped to an Orlikon, which is a 50 millimeter, or 50 caliber gun. And so I'm supposed to be spotting submarine, you know, the breathing tubes, and alert everybody and fire on it, I guess. So anyway, we were 2 hours on the bridge and on the gun, and 4 hours off, right around the clock.
And how long did that last?
well, as long as we were at, it was 7 days, I think, it took us to get over to Liverpool.
So much for being a passenger.
Yeah, so much for a troop ship. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, you got so that you were seeing mythical submarines. Mm. You know, you were staring at the ocean so much that you'd actually see a submarine and you have to clear it with somebody else that, am I right? Or
is this a mirage?
like a mirage. Yeah. So they confirmed that no, there was no submarine out there. You just imagine it. Go and have a rest. And so that was my trip overseas. And we pulled into Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And there was a fellow on the dock. I guess he was one of the people that moored the ships and tied them up, etc. And he stood back in the middle of the dock and he saluted us and he said, "Welcome, Canada." I'll never forget it. So they finally got a troop train in there a short time later. And then we got on that, and our first meal was beans on toast. And I'd never had beans on toast in my life.
You can't get much more British than that.
That's right. And so that was my first trip, first memory, really, of being overseas, was beans on toast.
So from Liverpool, where were you taken to?
To the operational training units, where they just sent all the aircrew, hundreds of people, aircrew people, into this place, OTU. And you sorted yourself out into crews. Crews were not formed. They let you form your own crews.
So how did that process work?
It was wonderful. We just, you know, I was one of the last to crew up. And okay. I said, I'm not going to be too eager about going to war here. So I held back. I laid back. And the chap that became my pilot was from Victoria. And he formed up with a navigator, who was from the Galt family, prominent family in Montreal.
Oh. Okay.
And I didn't know anything about the Galt family at that time. But anyway, they had two. They agreed to form up. And then the next person they wanted to get was a WAG, a wireless operator air gunner. And it was me. And they came up to me, and I was one of the last individuals that hadn't joined up with the crew, and said, well, I guess I better crew up now. Mm-hmm. And hung back. And so we crewed up. And then the next was to get an engineer.
Yeah.
Engineer, and then the gunners. Mm-hmm.
And did you stick with this same crew throughout the whole time?
Except for the mid-upper gunner.
Oh.
Well, he went to sleep in his turret. And so we said goodbye to him.
So did you have a permanent replacement for him?
No, we had spare gunner. There was always spare gunners that hadn't crewed up because we lost gunners. And you could always get a spare gunner. And so from then on, we just got spare gunners for that upper turret.
Now, where were your crew members, apart from your missing mid-upper gunner? Mm. Where were they from? Were they mostly Canadian?
All Canadian. We were, up until then, pretty well all the flight engineers were RAF. And we were one of the first crews to get a Canadian as the flight engineer. And we had some doubts about him, too.
Oh, dear.
Well, it was his responsibility to keep check on the fuel.
Right.
And one of his jobs was to, at all times, completely conversant with the amount of fuel left.
Right.
So I can remember vividly the pilot calling He was a very skinny guy, and we called him Bones. The pilot called up and said, "Bones, how much fuel have we got left?" And Bones said, "I don't know."
Uh-oh.
So we had another meeting concerning Bones' future with us.
Bones were rattled.
So anyway, as he was Canadian, mm-hmm. we said, "Oh, we'll keep him. We'll keep an eye on him."
And the fuel.
So that was a discussion amongst us all.
So from the operational training event, you crewed out. What was your next? Your next stop.
The next sort of stop was advanced flying unit, I guess.
Okay.
And they were all on Wellingtons. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, we hadn't flown in England until we got to this OTU, Operational Training Unit. Anyway, that's where I got into the British communication systems.
Oh, so how did that work?
And what was that? Well, they were British. It was British gear in the aircraft, and they had 1082-83s, receivers and transmitters. And then we moved on to the next level, at the advanced flying unit. I don't know if they were good. And then we had the next level up in communications equipment, which was 1082-83.
Okay, so very powerful stuff.
Yeah. Now they had to...
Now, what had you been trained on in Canada?
The first...
So when you were way back...
Yeah, it was all British gear. Canada didn't have any manufacturing at that stage. So, the 1082-83 initially, and then as you moved up into OTU, you got on 1154-45, and then the next level of gear. And then associated with that, now we're getting into operational flying.
But just before we get into operational flying, so was there much of an adjustment to the different radios?
Used to, of course.
And do you think that your training, both as a wireless operator and as a gunner, was adequate for what you faced?
Well, absolutely. But I never touched a gun. Because when you get to that stage, you've got two gunners and sometimes three. And so I was strictly a communicator. Now, one of my jobs also was they had microphones in the starboard inner engine.
Mm.
And once we got over Germany, we back to the ground controllers, they were all women, would vector the fighters on our bomber stream.
Oh, because they would be able to pick you up
on their ground radar. Then they had microphones in our starboard inner engine connected to our transmitter radio, and our job was to listen to the girls on the ground vectoring their fighters on our bomber stream and back tune our transmitters to their frequency and then throw the switch on and blast them with all this engine noise. And I'd break off anyway, and the girls would be crying on the ground because they couldn't get through to the vector fighters on us. And they were frustrated because the noise was horrific.
Oh, that was just deafening.
And I crack up the noise level to it with absolutely ear splitting problems for them. Anyway, I'd take a break and back tune to them, and they'd be crying.
So, other than making the German radar girls cry, what were your duties when you were on a trip?
Well, as soon as we got over there, we had tinsel, which was a strips of paper with this metallic strips on it, so it would show up on the German radar, because their radar would pick it up. And
so it would look like hundreds of little planes.
It looks like a complete snowstorm. And and the radar people would be completely jammed with this stuff. And it was an early stage of electronic countermeasure, ECM, they called it. And that's what I was busy at. So I never had a chance to look out and see the fires and all the going down.
So did you have a chute to push this?
Yeah, it was right there. My position was directly below the pilot.
Okay.
And he couldn't see what I was doing down there, below him. And he'd keep shouting at me, "Get the strips out, Doug!" I said, "Jesus, I'm working my ass off here."
Well, of course, he couldn't see what was going on.
Yeah. He couldn't see what I was doing. He just yelled at me. I said, "For Pete's sake, leave me alone. I'm doing my job."
So what else did your job involve other than throwing out windows?
Well, there was every half hour, Bomber Command sent a message every half an hour. There would be a Bomber Command message through. And it was just cut through everything. It was a very powerful message. You couldn't, even if somebody else was trying to commute with you, he overpowered it all. Well, it could be radio. But they would give us change of targets, possibly, or winds. We had to get the winds. The navigators needed winds to maintain their navigation, or plus winds, and change of heights. All these things that were was after you had left, after you'd taken off. The only messages we got were through Bomber Command messages. And all, as I suggested, change of targets, change of tracks, and change of speeds, and weather changes, and that sort of thing. And we never answered them. We just copied what they sent us. That was it.
And then pass that along.
Pass that on to the pilot and the navigator, or whoever was appropriate, the flight engineer if he was awake. It's not fair.
And of course he'd be paying close attention to his fuel gauge.
Yes.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the aircraft that you were flying?
Well, we were flying an operational training unit, OTU. We flew in Wimpy's Wellington's on two engine aircraft, geodetic construction. And I didn't, but my pilot could land them just beautifully. And
how did you like the Wellington?
Well, I didn't like them because I couldn't see out.
Why is that?
Well, it was a geodetic construction, and they didn't have any windows in it except for the navigator and the pilot and people up front, from the sharp end. And all I had to do was take messages and pass them on by paper.
There's no view.
But I couldn't see out. And I didn't like that. And I said to my, used to say to myself, if this thing crashes and gets on fire, how can I get out? There was no way I could get out. Because the geodetic construction It wasn't even big enough for my 20-year-old body or 21-year-old body to get through this size of a hole. And so I didn't like them for that reason. And I always wore helmets and goggles because, well, I said, at least I can save my eyes if we burn. You know, it's being real.
Yeah. And but you didn't, did you fly these operations?
No. We flew them. We didn't get to that stage until we got to the next level of aircraft. We were introduced to four-engine aircraft.
Okay.
And they were marked 5 Halifaxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had radial engines, no, inline engines in them.
Okay.
And if we're subject to failure on takeoff, you lose an engine and you waddle around and try and maintain airspeed and height.
Now, did that ever happen to you?
Yes, we did.
Can you tell me sort of what happened when you, stalled on takeoff?
Well, you didn't stall. You'd lose an engine. They'd just stop, back up, and large volumes of blue smoke issued out of them, but you still had 3 engines.
Yes.
And of course, part of our training at that stage was to cut off each engine in turn. You were left with 1.
Right.
And in our case, you never lost that. You never shut the 4th engine off.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you lost 3 engines deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at that stage in training, reducing our engine power. And the instructor was sitting up with the pilot, of course, and he was a co-pilot, actually. And then he'd knock an engine off, and the pilot would have to adjust whatever he had to do there. And then he'd knock another one off. Now you only had 2 engines. And then you knock another one off, now you got 1 engine. And you're wobbling in the air there, barely maintaining altitude and speed. And then this particular idiot reached over to turn the 4th one off.
Oh, no.
And the pilot just swatted him across the forearm, and then he suddenly realized what he was doing. He was prepared to crash us. Anyway, we survived that. But we did fly on 1 engine.
Mm-hmm.
We waddled along weren't flying probably. But it was an experience for the pilot to realize what it was like to fly these things. And that was on Mark 5, so, which was an inline engine, like a Lancaster was.
Mm-hmm. And did you stay on the Mark 5?
No. That was only for that period, short period. Then we went to the squadron,
And what squadron were you assigned?
420, City of London, Ontario.
Okay.
And it was a snowy owl squadron. And so our squadron had this stuff. Somebody in Canada said it was a snowy owl. Stuff, a taxidermist had made it up for us, and it was an actual snowy owl. It came over from Canada. I can't remember the details. But we had a snowy owl squadron, 420, City of London, Ontario. And they used to send us cases of oranges at Christmas time.
Oh, nice.
There was no oranges in any place in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But our squadron had oranges. And the porcupine squadron were adopted by the porcupine mines in northern Ontario, in the mining country up there.
Were they sent to porcupine?
No. Anyway, the porcupine mines squadron Porcupine Mines adopted the Porcupine Squadron. And they sent them pajamas for Christmas. You can imagine how that went over.
I think you scored a better deal with the with the oranges.
Absolutely. I don't know whether they even wore them. Not likely. It was a standing joke.
So 420 Squadron, we were flying. What aircraft were you flying?
Well, we were in Halifax. Halifax. Well, first of all, Halifax 5s, which had inline engines in them. When we graduated to the squadron, we got Halifax Mark 3s with radio engines.
Yes.
And marvelous airplane, marvelous engines.
And how did they compare to the Merlin engines, the inline engines?
Well, eventually, we had a load of 12,000 pounds.